All right, everybody, welcome back to the Physician Syndicate podcast. I am one of your hosts, Greg.
And I'm your other host, Ronak.
All right, so today we're going to go into sort of a deep dive into one of the topics that we chatted about on yesterday's podcast, the pitch deck. So pitch decks have become super important for me personally, and also for any startup founders that are out there. Pitch decks are the way you communicate with potential venture capitalists, potential angel investors. And you also usually put together a pitch deck for clients as well, which is called a client deck. We won't go into that. But today we'll talk a little bit more about the actual investment pitch deck. What goes in it, why it's important, what information you definitely want to have in it, what information you don't necessarily want to have in it. And we'll go kind of slide by slide. Typically, decks for investment are anywhere between like 9 to 13 slides. 13 at the longest. And they also sometimes have appendices where you really go into a deep dive if somebody really wants a lot of information.
Before we get started here, there are two quick points I do want to make about pitch decks. They typically are the first introduction that a potential investor has to your startup. So a lot of times investors will want to read through the pitch deck before actually taking a meeting with you to start asking you questions and really grilling you on what the business model is, what the product and service is. So if you don't get the pitch deck correct, it's actually very difficult to get that initial meeting where you can explain through different things. So if you are looking to raise money, I think it is a good idea to spend quite a bit of time on just like perfecting the pitch deck and just making it as robust as possible. The second thing, and Greg, I know we'll go into this slide by slide, but I think there are just some high-level things about pitch decks that everybody should be thinking about and just making sure they're correct. And that's just making sure everything is legible and just like aesthetically looks appropriate, right? Like I've definitely received pitch decks where they're using white font on a yellow background and I can't even read anything that they're saying. I remember Steve Jobs having a quote, something along the line that like when you're making a pitch deck, you want to find out who you're pitching to. Find out the age of the oldest person that's going to be in the room, and then make your smallest font the size of their age, right? I've definitely seen people that try to cram like, you know, a 5,000 word essay on one slide, and the font size like 2 points, and I just can't read anything. And these are like rookie mistakes that I see a lot of entrepreneurs making. Just make everything clear, legible. You know, you can always explain things in a deeper dive during a meeting. But just make this functional, right? Again, this is the first introduction that somebody has to your startup. And if they see that you can't even, you know, create a good contrast between the letters and the background of your slide, how are they going to take you seriously for actually building out a startup?
The other aspect is that when I get, you know, outbound or I guess inbound interest from founders that are looking to raise capital, you know, usually through LinkedIn or sometimes through an email if they can find my email address. You know, a lot of times they won't send the deck. They'll just say, hey, I have this really cool idea for this thing that I want to do. We're raising $3 million for it. Are you interested? And it's like, you got to do a little bit more research than that. And also send your deck. Like if you're asking for investment, send your deck up front. Do not be coy or shy about sending it. If you don't want it to be, you know, forwarded along to everybody else, you know, send something that's a shareable link. That's a URL that can go to like a DocSend, or even Canva has the feature now where you can just send it without actually having to send an actual file. But don't be the person that doesn't send a deck. Like if you're really trying to raise capital and you don't have a deck, 100 times out of 100, I'm not going to give you any money. Like it's not going to happen unless you actually have a deck and you've thought through what you're trying to say in that deck. And so, yeah, we'll get started with kind of going slide by slide, and then also just give you like an overview of why decks are important and what mistakes you don't want to actually make on these decks. All right, so let's just jump right into kind of the first few slides of the pitch deck. Lays the foundation a little bit of what somebody's going to be looking for when they're looking through your deck. So typically your first slide is going to be some cover page, some image. Maybe it's a couple images of your actual product if you have one. If not, maybe it's just like, I don't know, some kind of image that is thrown up as a way of saying, here's our company. This is what our name is. This is what we do. And so it's really just like two things, name of the company, what you're doing. That's about it. That's kind of the title cover of everything.
Yeah, I would just make sure that you have maybe like a contact for an email address, what your name is and what your company name is. And that's really the core things that you need. nice graphics is great, but if you don't have your name or your company name, something's wrong there. So just make sure you have those basic elements there. Very, very simple, straightforward slide.
Also, there's a link to some early stage large companies that are now large, their original pitch decks that they actually used to pitch. So I think like Airbnb's is out there. I think Stripes is out there. So we'll put that into the show notes. So typically like a second page or close to the first page is going to be your team slide. So this is actually a pretty important slide. You really want to hit on a lot of the highlights of your team. So if it's just you, then it's just you. If it's you and a couple co-founders, then you really want to highlight kind of why this team is uniquely positioned to go after this specific startup idea. So, you know, if you're going into AI, you're going to want to have somebody on there that has some kind of background with artificial intelligence, machine learning, natural language processing, like whatever actual AI piece you're going into, you're probably going to want somebody with that type of background. If not, you might get laughed at a little bit. Like, you're just going to plug it in ChatGPT. We know what you're going to do. Like, you don't necessarily have like a founder advantage. And so you really want to highlight, if you do have that, what your advantage is as a founder. So in my specific situation, when we launched FlipMD, it was, I'm a physician that had this exact problem. That was the reason that I wanted to start this company. And that was why we felt uniquely positioned to go after the idea. And so, Ronak, do you want to talk a little bit more about kind of what goes on the founder slide?
Yeah, I think brand names are actually really nice to have here, as well as titles that you might have held previously. So, you know, I came from the big tech world. Being able to say Tesla, Facebook, Spotify on that team page is always really helpful. I held the title of data scientist. So that was also really helpful in case we did have any type of AI twist to it. So you could think about just like, you know, looking at your resume and teasing out what are those brand names, places that you've worked at, schools that you've gone through, degrees that you've received, any sort of accreditation that just gives you any kind of like emphasis on a specific subject matter area that's related to your startup is going to be really helpful. This is also a place where you could add information on your advisors. So if you did bring somebody on, you know, giving them like, let's say 1% of the company as a consulting, and they come on as an advisor to just like help you out and guide you along, this is where you can get some like brand name people to be a part of your slide deck, right? Like if you are starting a digital health startup, for example, and you have two advisors, one that's a big name doctor and one that's a big name technologist, that's really going to help it along. And whatever schools that they went to or companies that they've worked at or founded before, you can add that on your slide deck as well. So again, I think here you're just really trying to prove out that you're not just some random person going after this problem. What is it about you and your team that, you know, how can you sort of like show that you have the credentials and the experience to know this problem a little bit more intimately and have the skill sets to actually solve it?
And again, this is not something that you want to put your entire CV on. So physicians, like most of you, have CVs rather than resumes, which goes into like supreme academic details of papers you've written, books you've authored, chapters, presentations. You do not need any of that on this slide. You really want to focus on areas of expertise that is relevant to this startup that you're building. And in the appendix, you can put like links out to like your PubMed articles or something else like that if they're relevant to what you're building. The other thing you want to throw on here too is just like roles. So you want to make sure you know exactly who is the CEO, who's the chief technology officer, who is the chief operating officer, whatever other roles you have in the startup already. And make sure you kind of delineate exactly who those people are. And again, just put the high level overview of what your expertise is and what you're bringing to the table. All right, so going through the deck, again, the next one is kind of just an introduction of what your company is trying to do. You want to really get down to the details of like, here's the idea. This is why we're doing it. This is where we came from. And just kind of like another high level overview again. Maybe look at your landing page and pull some of the copy from your landing page to start to understand, you know, how are you trying to sell it to customers so that you can then sell it to a VC that's going to be going through your deck. The other thing I would say is with these decks, the other nice thing that you can do with those like DocSends and the Canva URLs is actually see where do people stop and really pay attention on your deck. So maybe you only send this deck out to like 5 VCs at first, and then you actually take the feedback that you can see without even them telling you anything, like, oh, they stopped on the team slide for like 3 minutes and then they proceeded and they only spent like 10 seconds on everything else. It's like, then you should really beef up your team page. And so for this introduction, though, super high level, like, here is what we're going after. Here's the reason. Here's how we're going to do it. Maybe some of the features, but otherwise, pretty simple slide.
Yeah, and just to make it a little bit more concrete, like, let's say you were originally Facebook and you're putting together a pitch deck. This is where you say that, like, we're building an online social network targeted at college students, right? It's maybe a little bit more than that, but not too much more. You don't want to go into the details of the advertising model and, like, the strategies that you're using to recruit users or anything like that. Again, this is just like a high level, what are you doing? You could sort of think about this as like a slide that summarizes your elevator pitch. So an elevator pitch is, you know, like in a world where you happen to get in an elevator with some prominent investor and you have about 30 seconds with them, how do you describe your startup as quickly as possible so you can get the message across to see if they'll take a future meeting with you, right? So same thing with this slide. You have one slide. You don't want it to be too busy or too detailed, but just maybe like the equivalent of, like, I don't know, call it like 3 or 4 sentences that really just summarize what you're doing, broken down into a few bullet points, just a high level, like, literally, what are you guys doing?
And you can think about it in this way too, where you want to make sure that when they get through that slide, they know what you're doing. So if you had to quiz them and said, you know, am I a marketplace? Am I a AI vertical software? Like, what is it that you're actually doing? And you want to make sure you answer that specific question before you go off into the rest of the slides. So if you can't do that succinctly on one slide, you need to figure out how to.
So, Greg, one question for you is, for this slide in particular, how do you feel about buzzwords? Buzzwords are, you know, dropping things like blockchain and artificial intelligence and machine learning or whatever it is, just to drop in those names. My quick 2 cents is, I think doing a little bit might make sense. Doing it excessively probably doesn't make sense, but curious just to get your take on, when you see a pitch deck with a lot of buzzwords, what goes through your head?
Yeah, what goes through my head is usually they don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're focused on. So yeah, I've seen decks. I think I've told you that story, Ronak, where it's like crypto, Web3, NFTs, blockchain, etc. Like, literally all the Web3 things that you could possibly say. And it's like, I don't know how those are supposed to fit into what you're trying to build. Like, it becomes confusing. I think if you are going to have one or two of those features, sure. But again, like, when a VC or an angel investor goes through your deck and they're like, oh, they just mentioned a bunch of buzzwords, and then you go and pitch them and you forget to mention those, it's like, that's a red flag for me. It's like, you literally are just putting AI, NLP, machine learning into a deck because you think that's the hot thing to do, not necessarily because there's an actual application for it. That's always my concern. But if you are doing those things, yeah, definitely put it in there, right? Like, if you are sincerely going out and saying, like, we're going to be building up an entirely new algorithm based off of this data set, and we're going to be using this to then build out this new product that's going to save physicians a bunch of time, say it. But if it's, like, not true, just leave it out. Like, it can be a regular company. It doesn't necessarily have to be an AI company or, you know, 6 months ago, a Web3 company.
Right. I would just add here that whatever buzzwords that you do use, make sure you actually understand what the buzzword means. I mean, if you get a question like in the first 5 minutes of like an actual pitch meeting and you say that you're, I don't know, let's say an artificial intelligence company, and you get a question about like what a convoluted neural net is, and you can't answer that, meeting's basically over, right? It's like, if you're going to add buzzwords, make sure you know what they actually mean.
Yeah, and if you're like, well, I'm the CEO, I don't know what those words mean, have your CTO on that call with you so they can answer that question then. Because again, like, I don't know nearly as much as Ronak knows about artificial intelligence and data science and all that stuff. I've studied up on it, but it's like, if I got that question, yeah, I would struggle too. So make sure that the team, hopefully the team can be all on that initial call to actually understand this is why this team is building this. But totally agree. If you don't know what you're talking about, that's a huge red flag to try to build a company and potentially raise millions of dollars from VCs. It's going to be difficult to do unless you actually understand what you're doing and not just saying AI, ChatGPT, OpenAI, blah, 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 blah. All right, next slide. So after that introduction, again, that's a high-level introduction. You want to really jump into what the hell is the problem that you're solving? Why is it a problem? Who is it a problem for? How big of a problem is this? So this is your problem slide. This is always, for me, a super important slide. It gives me a really good sense of this startup's ability to understand their customer and understand the market that they're going into and how well they know this problem, right? Do they know this problem back and forth, inside out? Or is it they're just taking a shot in the dark and saying AI might be able to help, you know, a shipping company make routes more efficient? It's like, tell me why you know that. Tell me why this is a problem. And really just focus on the problem. So is it a time problem? Is it a money problem? Like whatever your idea is, it, you know, typically when you're a physician, if you have an idea, it's because you've had a problem. So really think through, why is this a problem, not just for me, but for 90% of other physicians in XYZ specialty or whatever it is. So you can at least start to really formulate that problem side with the idea of, when I go through this, you know, with a VC or an angel investor, I'm not even going to look at the slide because I know exactly what the problem is. I know exactly how to articulate this problem. And if you don't, go back and think through, is this a problem that actually needs to be solved? So there's always the question that investors think about is it a painkiller or a vitamin, right? Which one are you? What is this problem? Is it I'm in pain and I need help, or yeah, this is kind of nice to have, you know, a daily vitamin, whatever. Like, you really want to find problems that are going to solve pain points for people. So make sure you understand what the problem is and can really flush it out as much as you can.
Yeah, so one of the best examples that I've seen of this, and this is not in the medical or healthcare space, but actually a few years ago, we started seeing all these electrical scooters being dropped in all the major cities around the world. You know, I think the companies were like Bird and Lime and a few of those. So this original idea came from a few folks that were working at places like Uber and Lyft. And, you know, by working there and seeing the data, they were able to see that you know, Uber and Lyft was definitely taking off. Ride sharing was becoming a bigger and bigger thing in the world. But the unit economics did not work for trips at, I think it was less than 2 miles. That if you're traveling like 5 miles, the driver coming picking you up and dropping you off, the unit economics works for the driver, it works for the rider, it works for the company. But once you go with these shorter trips, like half a mile, mile and a half, the economics starts breaking down. So it didn't make sense for Uber and Lyft to, you know, take on those short trips. At the same time, from a user standpoint, people still need to get around. Not everybody wants to walk a mile or has the time to walk and wants to get there a little bit quicker. So that's where they were able to uniquely see this open problem in the marketplace and find a solution around it.
Yeah, I always forget about those scooter companies. They're not doing well anymore, but they were all the rage for quite a while, actually. And yeah, they basically saw that as the big problem and tried to figure out the solution to it. The problem is that not a ton of people in different age demographics want to get on an electric scooter and ride next to cars and stuff like that. I think that was their big issue. Not necessarily that it wasn't a good solution. It's just not a solution for everybody, I think, is the issue.
Yeah, but these companies were able to raise money at billions of dollars of valuations. It was a very clear answer as to what is the problem that they're trying to solve. And I think that's what I'm really trying to get at. Whether they have a successful business model or not, put that aside. But like, it's just very easy to articulate what the problem is that they're going after. And I think you can have that in the healthcare and medical space as well, right? Like, what is the problem that you're going after? Like, if you are a clinical physician, you know, what kind of roadblocks are you seeing in your day-to-day work? Why is it a problem? And just like explaining some of the aspects at it that maybe somebody that's not a physician and seeing these problems day-to-day and being able to articulate to them is very important.
Yeah, I think that's a great example, though, of like seeing a problem and doing a very good job of also just like defining the problem, right? Like, this is the problem for these trips within these certain miles, within certain cities, and like, here's our solution. So you're right. Like, that is a completely correct problem to go after, right? Like, if Uber and Lyft are keeping one segment of a gigantic market and they're just like, hey, we don't really care about it, it's a great thing for you to go into as a startup and expand from there. Speaking of kind of the solution piece, so that's usually the next slide, right? So you usually go from problem, what is the problem, really define it quite well, and go jump right into your solution. So specifically going back to your problem side, you want to make sure that your solution covers as many problems as you talk about. So if you're like, there's 8 problems with prior authorizations, I think that's the example we used the other day. You want to make sure that your technology ultimately can cover most of those problems, because, you know, if you're not solving the problem completely, it's going to be hard necessarily to get a lot of people to use it unless it's solving the entire problem. So you really want to break it down into, here are the solutions that we're bringing out specifically for XYZ problems that we see within the prior authorization field. And so you really want to be as specific as you can, even if you're a pre-seed company, you haven't built anything yet. But this at least shows your thought process and gets to the point of like, okay, you've thought through the problem, you know what your solutions are, and I as the investor can be like, that's a technology that's capable of being built, right? It's not like a fairy tale that you would have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to bring to market, and we have no idea if the market's even there. So you want to make sure that you break it down again into these like really easy to digest components where you're not explaining in like 3,000 words on a slide, but like really try to keep it succinct and understand, here's the solution to the problem I just talked about.
Yeah, and I would also add, just to be a little bit realistic here, going too pie in the sky really turns off some investors, right? Like Greg's saying, you do want to make sure you have enough bullets and information there to solve where your solution is solving the problem. But again, we want to limit the number of words that are on the slide. You don't want to have a 5,000 word essay on the slide. At the same time, if you're, I don't know, let's say building a plane company and you are putting a bullet there saying that like plane trips are too expensive, so we're going to build a plane for $40 each, that's unrealistic. Right. So you want to make sure that whatever solution or technology you're putting together is reasonable and it makes sense. If you're going to have a bullet point on there saying that we're going to make the world's greatest LLM model, and none of you guys have an AI background, that's a little bit of a stretch, right? Just make sure what you're putting together at least sounds reasonable, that you guys can actually go and do it. Maybe you didn't build it out yet, and that's fine, but at least you have like the vision and the roadmap to be able to build it.
Next one, super important slide. And we'll put in links to this one specifically because I've seen a lot of people do this differently. So it's the market sizing slide. How do you size the market that you're going after? And I would use the market that you're going after initially, not necessarily like if everything works out and then you're able to expand your TAM. Like we could talk about that later in terms of like, how do you expand a TAM? But you really want to make a baseline. This is the total addressable market that we're going after. So typically, if you're in the US, you know, you're going to focus on the US economy and say, okay, this is the solution. Again, if you're doing a prior auth solution, there's a little over 1 million physicians in the US. That's your total addressable market, a little over 1 million. The problem is that you need to then break it down into a serviceable available market as well as a serviceable obtainable market. So you want to think through, not every physician has to deal with prior auths. Like I, as a radiologist, never did a prior auth. So that takes away all radiologists. Pathologists, probably not. Like there's a few specialties that just get completely wiped out from your TAM because they don't ever have to deal with the problem that you're going to solve. And you want to be honest about that. Like you don't want to be like, okay, our TAM is 1 million physicians. They're going to pay us each $10,000 a year. It's like, that's probably not going to happen, you know, especially if you're building in like an AI prior auths thing. Like that's going to have to be an enterprise sales, likely to a hospital. So you really want to think through, how do you size your market correctly, but also leave the VC, like leaving that slide being like, okay, that's a big enough market that I can see if they took a lot of the market share, they could have a really, really, really big exit. So typically when I'm looking at a market sizing chart, if they're insane and they're like, this is a $3 trillion market, I'm like, no, it's not. Like, it's really not. Then A, I think you're not a very smart founder, or you're trying to like pull the wool over my eyes. So you want to have it realistic, but you also want to keep it big enough that like it's interesting to people. So don't lie, but think through, how can I show that this market is actually what I say it is? I mean, Ronak, any thoughts on that? Just kind of, you know, general thoughts on the market sizing slide. We've seen a lot of them. A lot of them are done differently. A lot of people do top down versus bottoms up and things like that. We can talk about that too.
Yeah, I would add on this slide, you do want to add a little bit of math on how you are getting to the total addressable market. Don't just put a number out there. The total addressable market is $2 billion and that's it. No, what are the calculations that are going into that, right? Like, are you looking at the number of physicians? Are you looking at the number of hospitals? Are you looking at an expected price that you're going to be selling your product for? Like, how do you actually get to that calculation? I would also try to skew, if you were to skew a little bit too small or a little bit too big, I would recommend going too small, because I think if you go too big, it just looks like you're dreaming and you're not living in the real world. And if you go with a little bit too small and you, I mean, if you ultimately get sales that are higher than your total addressable market, nobody's going to complain at that. That's actually going to be a really good thing that your, maybe your company is actually growing the market, right? That can definitely happen. So I would say just like, let the math do the talking on this slide. Don't go crazy with as big of a TAM as possible, because then it just becomes unreasonable. And also like, think about how much you're raising with what your TAM is, right? So, you know, if you're putting together a startup that's raising $50,000 at a seed round versus $5 million at a seed round, these are two very different raises, right? So if you're going after a $5 million seed round, you know, you do need a healthy TAM, right? If your TAM is only $15 million, that's not interesting. But if you're raising $50,000 and your TAM is $50 million, you know, that's at least like reasonable.
Yeah, the other thing you want to think about with this slide is, how is a VC thinking about this, right? So we can do an entire episode on like venture capital dynamics, but when a venture capital backs a venture capitalist backs a company, most of the time they're thinking in the back of their head, do I think this company could potentially return the fund? So what does that mean? If I am a venture capitalist, let's say with a $50 million fund, and you're a pre-seed company, I'm looking to take potentially, let's say, just 10% of your company and assume no dilution. What kind of outcome would this specific company have in order for me to return $50 million to my fund, which means that I've returned enough capital to then start taking carry? So let's see, a $50 million outcome. You can help me with the math here, Ronak. If you're taking 10%, that would have to be a $500 million. Yeah, $500 million outcome. So if you think about it that way, if I'm a VC, I want to be able to underwrite you, if everything goes correctly, to a $500 million acquisition. Yeah, it's probably not going to be an IPO, but let's say it's an acquisition. So that means I have to believe that you can get to $50 million in revenue, assuming you get a 10x multiple on your revenue, in order to actually return the fund. That's the math that venture capitalists are making in the back of their head, looking at every single investment. Do I think this can return the fund? And if you go into a bigger fund, $250 million fund, you have to think in larger and larger scale outcomes, because that's what they have to do. If they're only betting on 20 companies per fund, again, going back to the power law, 90 plus percent of returns come from like less than 10% of companies. So you might have one winner in that entire batch, which 3x's your entire fund. And then everything else on top of that is just like icing, right? So when you're thinking through this TAM slide, you got to think about your investors. If you're going to somebody that has a $50 million fund, you have to say, how do I get to $50 million in revenue with this company? Because if I do, it's probably going to be interesting to this venture capitalist. If I can't, it's probably not going to be. So you have to have a really good sense of who you're going after, because again, a 3x or a 4x or a 5x on for a venture capitalist is nothing. It's a drop in the bucket to a large fund. For an angel investor, that could be a pretty nice little exit, because you don't have a fund that you're trying to return. You get 100% of that capital back when they exit. Ronak, do you want to say anything about that before we just jump into the difference between TAM, SAM, and SOM?
Yeah. I would just add here that like, if you're thinking to yourself, okay, let me just try raising as much money as I can at as high of a valuation as possible. So let's say I'm going to try raising a $10 million seed round. I think you need more and more evidence of potential success, whether that's the team slide that we talked about, right? Like if it's, I mean, I hate to use this as an example. If you have one company where the core founder is a high school dropout versus another founder that is a former congressman at the federal level, you know, those are two very different types of people, right? Or if you have some like crazy,
I would back the high schooler.
Would you really? A congressman
depends,
with all their connections?
On okay, how we should take this amazing that high schooler is. Is it the next Mark Zuckerberg?
Yeah, but remember, Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, Michael Dell, Larry Ellison, all these college dropouts, they dropped out from some of the best schools in the world. They did not drop out because they couldn't get into an Ivy League school, right? So they clearly are very, very intelligent folks. All I'm saying is that like, you know, we're trying to match up with the amount that you're raising with the TAM that you're going after. And if you want to go after that higher raise and that higher TAM, you're going to need more evidence of potential success. So whether that is your previous resume or engagement with the products that you've already put out there in the market, folks are going to want to see more evidence of potential success if you go with that higher TAM and that higher raising amount. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that's fair. So difference between TAM, SAM, and SOM quickly. There's plenty of YouTube videos you can watch on this to do a really thorough breakdown of this. But the way that I think about it is your TAM is, again, your total number of customers that you could ever potentially reach. So if you're doing prior auth, sure, put it as a million. But then your SAM, you have to start excluding people. So you have to start saying, okay, of those million people, maybe there's only 750,000 of them that are in specialties that even care about prior auths. So now your SAM is more like 750,000 physicians times whatever you think you could actually charge that physician to get to some kind of annual revenue that you can potentially pull in. The SOM, so the last one, serviceable attainable market, you have to start thinking through, okay, of those 750,000 physicians, how many of them are in a position to potentially use my solution? So maybe 100,000 work for, you know, academic hospitals that already have some kind of prior auth solution. Maybe they have an internal thing, so likely are out. Maybe community hospitals are more your jam because your solution's a little bit cheaper than a lot of the other enterprise clients or a lot of the other enterprise solutions, and it's perfectly fit for a community hospital. So then you have to think, okay, I'm just going to put community hospitals and maybe private practices on my SOM slide, the SOM part of your slide. So then it's like, maybe it's only 300,000 physicians that potentially are a good match for what you're building. And then you figure out, okay, what's 300,000 times whatever you're going to have in terms of like an annual contract with each individual physician or each individual hospital system, whatever it is. So that you can get a really good sense of like, here's if I take the entire market, which is again, highly unlikely, here's the intermediate, and here's the what I think I can actually get to within the next 5 to 10 years. That's a quick and easy kind of way of thinking about it. But you really want to break that down and again, put your assumptions like Ronak is talking about. It's like a math problem in high school, right? Show your work. If you don't, I'm not going to assume that you did the work correctly. Like I will go back and I will double check that your numbers are actually right, that there's a little over a million physicians in the US, that you know there's a little over 300,000 people that are actually in community hospitals or private practices. Like if those numbers are off, probably not going to invest in you. I mean, they can be off by a little bit, sure, because there's different resources that show different numbers. But like, if you're saying there's 10 million physicians in the US, no, I'm walking away. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. All right. So this next slide. So again, TAM, SAM, SOM, super important, super, super important. I spent a lot of time on that. The next slide that I have in one of my old pitch decks is a go-to-market strategy. This is a plus or minus whether or not you have this. This is really just like, if you actually think through, how do I get my initial product out to people and all of that kind of stuff? I don't even know if we need to talk about this slide necessarily. It's basically just like strategy.
Yeah, I would just add here, if you do have some superpower go-to-market strategy, go ahead and make the slide. If you don't have anything, no need to force it. And your strategy, your super strategy for go-to-market could be something like a physician syndicate podcast that you somehow get onto and are able to sell your product to additional physicians really quickly.
Yeah, I would say that a lot of VCs actually do want to see a go-to-market strategy, especially like after the first or second meeting. So you can put it together then too. It doesn't need to be like it's in your pitch deck. Maybe it's like an appendix to your pitch deck later on. But this is just a way that like a VC or an angel investor just starts thinking or seeing the way that you think about the market. It's like if you are going and saying like, I'm going to go sell this prior authorization to chief information officers at all of the large academic institutions, it's going to take me 3 months to get into each one. Now I know exactly how delirious you are, right? How insane you are. Like you're not going to be able to do that. It's not that easy. But if you're like, I'm going to start with community hospitals and private practices that I already have relationships with, I'm going to start selling into there. Or maybe even start at the individual physician level and you start doing a bottoms up approach and you say, okay, I'm going to do individual physicians within as many different departments as I can, and then go to the department level people and ask to create some kind of enterprise account with individual departments before I start to go up to the C-suite. So like you have to start thinking about how do you get your product into the hands of the end users and at least show that you've thought about it in a coherent way that's not insane. That's really the only thing that I'm looking for with go-to-market strategy is like, you understand the barriers, you understand what's going to be difficult, and you understand what drivers and levers you have to pull as a startup founder.
Yeah, so like we were saying, this slide is kind of optional. If you have some great go-to-market strategy, definitely include it, but you can always add this later on during future meetings. I would say that this is a very important thing for any startup founder to think about, even if it doesn't go into the pitch deck itself. I've definitely seen companies that have started, they put together a pretty cool app for like the iPhone or Android devices. And once they publish it to the App Store, nobody downloads it, right? How do people find it? How do people know about it? right? These are important questions to at least ask yourself.
All right. Another one that I think is one of the most important slides that I tend to not see as much as I wish is just a competition slide. Like, who in the space is already doing something similar or remotely similar to what you are proposing? Like, if you're, again, doing AI prior auth and you don't include all of AI, no clue. No, like, I'm not going to back you. Like, you're saying that you don't understand the field enough to know that there's a player that raised over $900 million. Like, if you don't know that information or you don't want to tell me that information, either I'm not going to trust you or I think you're dumb. Like, those are the two options that I have when people forego putting in a competition slide. The other thing is, everybody has competition. I don't care what you're doing. I don't care how unique your idea you think is. There is competition. There's somebody doing something remotely similar or exactly the same thing that you're doing. You could have a tremendous go-to-market strategy and a tremendous product that might 10x everything that the other company is doing, but there's still other companies doing it. Like, Google had tons of competitors. They had Yahoo, they had WebCrawler, they had all these other search engines. It's not like they didn't have competition. They were just 10x better than everybody else. That's why they won. But if you're going into a field and you're telling me there is no competition, I'm not going to back you. I don't trust you. Like, I don't trust that either you're not doing your homework to understand that there is competition, or you're trying to, like, again, pull the wool over my eyes and be like, oh, there's no competition. I'm the only one doing this. And if there is no competition, are you sure it's a good idea? Like, if there's nobody else even remotely in the space doing something similar, is it because there's no market there? Is it because it's too hard to penetrate? Like, the incumbents are just too powerful, too good? Like, maybe. Like, think about it. Airbnb had competition. They had Vrbo. There was already somebody in the market doing basically exactly what they ultimately wanted to do. It's just they were a lot better.
Yeah. So, Greg, I think this is the one slide that I think you and I probably disagree on the most. This is usually one of the least interesting slides to me. I usually just largely just gloss over it and move on. One, I think if the problem statement is well defined and the solution is well defined, it doesn't really matter if there's competition. Like we said, there's been other search engines before Google. You can come in and have a much better product and take over the entire space. So whether there is competition or not in the specific product area, I don't really dwell on too much. The other issue that I've seen with this slide is that founders are a little bit too complementary to their competition, right? The most effective slides that I've seen, you sort of list out the competitors, maybe the top four or five players that are in the space, and you specifically highlight the things that they're not doing, right? The fact that they've raised, let's say, $700 million or something like that is great, but, like, the investor can do their own homework. You don't need to make the case not to invest in your startup for the investors, right? You want to try to convince the investors why you're going to win. So if you go and look at everybody's products in this space and you find the biggest gap that each one of these competitors has and just list the gaps, I would say that's actually more interesting to me than, like, telling me why these three competitors are going to completely squash you if you try entering the marketplace.
My concern with the competition slide is more the fact that people don't put it in. That's more my concern, is that people either aren't looking to see who their competitors are. And again, I don't think you need to necessarily, like, follow your competitors and copy every feature that they put. That's not a way to win. That's just a way to look like everybody else. But I think there is a problem with people that just don't understand that competition exists and that it's out there. That's really my concern. It's not the fact that, like, you know, whether or not they're showing their strengths or weaknesses, I don't really give a shit. I'm more worried about, do you know that competition exists? Do you know that they're at least out there, right? That's really my concern, because I've seen so many decks that don't have competition slides, and I'm like, I need to know that you know that there's competition, or else, like, you don't know what you're getting into. There's one other thing I was going to say, I can't remember, but yeah, at least put it in. Like, again, it makes you look like either insincere or just ignorant if you don't know who the competition is. And if you don't think there's competition, I will tell you who your competition is, because I can do a very quick Google search and figure out there's three other competitors that just launched within the last year that are doing the exact same thing that you're doing. And I will ask you, what is your differentiator, right? Like, Ronak, a real life example, right? We're starting a newsletter. We started a newsletter. We're using Substack. I like it. It's good. And there's one other new big competitor in the space that's only raised like $4 million versus, I don't know how much Substack has raised. It's a lot more than that, called Beehive. And Beehive's value prop is very easy to understand. It's basically they do not take any money from the creator. So if you eventually open up your newsletter to subscriptions, Substack will take 10%. Beehive won't. So it's like if you're ever thinking about monetizing your newsletter, you're probably going to go with Beehive. And if you're not, then maybe you go with Substack. I don't know. I don't know what the exact features are with Beehive, but it seems like it's a very feature-focused new entrant into the economy with a different value prop and a different business model. And I think Substack is struggling a little bit because their only real take rate is their actual take from paid subscriptions, whereas Beehive, the newsletter actual founder or writer, has to pay a monthly subscription. It's a different business model, but it's very easy to understand what are the differentiators between the two. So one of the last slides that I put into Dex, and sometimes I see it, sometimes I don't, are just like high level, what are some of the features that you're looking to build? And this kind of goes back to your solution slide a little bit. Like you should have most of that hopefully within like a very easy to understand solution slide. But the features also gives a sense of like, where does the product go in the future? These are not things that are going to come out with like version one of the product that you're doing, but like the eventual stuff that you're going to do. So for example, going back to like the FlipMD stuff, the version one of the product was, can we get jobs up on a board and can we get physicians to see them and apply to them and bid to work with them and then accept payments? You know, Lauren, my wife, and the other FlipMD co-founder since then has put in hundreds or thousands of new features onto the website, which maybe you don't even know they exist, but whether it's to speed up the platform or whether it's to make communication a lot easier or whether it's to, you know, have a calendar within the actual website where people can book meetings with each other without having to go back and forth in email. Like there's all of these features that eventually will get built out. And for me, when I'm looking at Dex, I'm like, okay, at least I understand your product feature roadmap a little bit and understand where is this product going from the initial launch through, you know, maybe it's a year or two in and you're five or six versions in, but at least gives me an understanding of like where you're trying to go and the features you're trying to build to solve some of the problems that you've talked about in your problem slide. And then also just augments a little bit about the solution slide as well.
Yeah, I would just add here that having a timeline with this slide is very, very important. And if you think about like, what are the next five major milestones for your startup to accomplish, and you have them set up such that like, we're going to accomplish this milestone in 3 months, this one in 9 months, this one in 14 months, whatever it is, it gives me as the investor a little bit of confidence that you actually have a plan, you know what you're doing, and you're just an organized team.
All right, last but not least, the other super important slide. I would say like four of these slides are super, super important that I spend most of the time on. This is probably, it's probably the most important one to me, is your raise slide. So you need to go at the end of your deck and say, this is how much money we are trying to raise. This is the valuation that we are trying to raise at. And this is what we're going to use the funding for. So if you're raising $3 million and you're like, yeah, we're going to use this all for social media spend, it's like, well, that's fine if like you're a growth stage company that only needs to do marketing and that's it. But like if you're raising $3 million, I want to know exactly what you're doing. Are you hiring a bunch of engineers? Are you focusing more on product? Like what is the money actually going to be used for? And then also just what are the economics of the deal? You know, as an angel investor, I have certain thresholds usually in terms of like the valuation that I go up to. You know, I think the highest valuation clearly came from the Series A company I invested in, but I won't say exactly what that valuation was. But typically in like pre-seed and seed, if you're raising between at a valuation between like 5 and 20 million, if you're like a YC company that has a lot of momentum, push it up to maybe 30. That's very much pushing it, especially for like pre-product people. But I need to know, again, this goes back to like how well versed are you with the startup world? Like if you're coming in with like a $3 million raise on a $30 million valuation, you've never built a startup, you're a physician founder by yourself, you're probably not going to raise that capital. And you also want to think through also, this is like advice for founders in general. You want to get a high valuation, sure, but you also want to make sure that in the future, you're going to be able to raise more capital. Like if you're raising 3 on 30 or 5 on 30, you have to hit some crazy thresholds to be able to actually increase your valuation at the next round. Like there's one company that I know of that I got pitched. I won't say which part of the startup world it's in, but They raised back in 2021, height of the market, at a $50 million valuation with no revenue. And they want the same valuation. They're like, we're taking a, you know, basically just a, not a down round, but what is it called? A flat round. Yeah. So they're taking a flat round. I'm like, I don't think you deserve a $50 million valuation. Like, you have maybe, let's say they have $300,000 in revenue. It's like, you're still asking for a tremendous multiple on that revenue. It's just, I don't know how you feel about Ronak, but that's kind of the stuff that I think about when I look at the final, usually, like, what is the raise?
Yeah. So I think it's good to have a plan of like where you're going to spend the money. What type of employees are you going to hire? Just are you going to spend a little bit on marketing? Just like where is the money that you're raising actually going to go? You don't need to put this on the slide, but I would start thinking about the cap table management. You know, how big is your employee pool going to be? How much of the company do you ultimately want to give up? Like just what does that cap table look like? Let's say 6 to 12 months from when you're making this pitch. I would also add that like everything that we've been talking about for this pitch deck is probably for that very, very early stage startup where maybe there isn't even a product or an MVP that's put together yet. Once you start getting a product out there and starting to get customers, this is where things like growth rates, user expansion, cost of customer acquisition, lifetime value, all of these metrics start becoming very, very important. Once you get a little bit further along, once you're probably putting together version 2 or 3 of your pitch deck, these things start becoming very important. But for that initial pitch deck where you're just trying to still test out the idea, still trying to get an understanding, are there investors that are going to be interested in this problem statement or not? Those things can come a little bit later. And Greg, maybe we should do a deep dive on, you know, how to calculate an LTV, how to calculate a CAC on a future episode. But going back to that raising slide, I think this is probably where investors spend the most amount of time, just understanding your ask and your company valuation. Does it make sense, right? If you are building a new AI startup in the medical field, right, for what your vision is, does $1 million in the bank account make sense? Does $10,000 make sense? Does $10 million make sense, right? These are very, very different numbers. And if the money that you're looking to raise does not match your vision of what you need to build, you're probably not going to get the funding. And at the same time, thinking through what that valuation is and what the economics of the deal is just so important, right? You know, on one hand, you do want to make the deal enticing to investors so that way they say yes. But at the same time, you don't want to just give away your entire company all at once, right? So finding that right balance, this is much more of an art than a science. There's no, you know, magical mathematical formula that I can give you to sort of calculate what your valuation should be. But at the same time, this might be something where you just test out a little bit, right? You know, have a list of 15 VCs and for 5 of them have valuation A, for 5 of them have valuation B, and for 5 of them have valuation C, and see what kind of traction that you're getting with these different reach outs and conversations. And that'll start giving you an idea of like where the market is ready to give you a valuation of your company.
Yeah, the other last piece of information or advice I would give is like, if you do think that you need to raise $3 or $5 million to ultimately get the product to market, you can think about raising in different tranches, right? So like separate the raise into multiple different raises. You know, go to angel investors first and raise, you know, $300,000 or $400,000, get that V1 of the actual platform or product built. And maybe you can get a couple clients that actually are paying you real revenue. And then you can go out for like a formal seed round and say, okay, we have revenue, we have a product, we have really loyal customers that love the product, and we're looking to supercharge what we're doing. We're going to raise an additional $5 million. But it's like, maybe you have $1 million in contracts already. And it's like, okay, well, now you can support a $20 or $30 million valuation. And so I would think about it that way too. Is like, if you're trying to raise a large amount of capital, maybe break it down into a couple different raises so that you can go out and raise that first initial tranche, build the product, get some traction, get some numbers, get some metrics like Ronak was talking about, and then go into a much larger conversation with a large VC firm of saying, we built this with just this amount of money. We already have $1 million in revenue. We only spent, you know, 300,000. We have, I don't know, 800,000 in the bank, and we're looking to raise an additional $5 million. Like, that's a really good position to be in when you can not only say that you have a product, but you have actual revenue that's coming in from really delighted customers. And yeah, go do reference checks on the customers and look at the tech, do a demo. Like that becomes a lot easier of a position to actually raise capital when you have something to show and you have something to show for the product that you're bringing out.
And then if we flip this around for a second, right? If you are a physician that's looking to become an angel investor as opposed to an entrepreneur, this valuation figure is very important, what a startup is raising at for if you should invest or not, right? So we'll do a future episode doing a complete deep dive on the different ways to value a company, whether it is a startup, a two-person startup, or a giant company like Apple. There are different ways to sort of like get at what a company should be valued at, and we'll go through a few of those different methodologies.
All right, that ended up being a long episode. So we'll cut it here. I think we'll keep doing some deep dives on some of these like initial startup. How do you build them? How do you do these things? Yeah, we'll end it there. Thanks for joining the Physician Syndicate podcast.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that the information and opinions expressed on this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. Before making any investment decisions, we strongly recommend that you consult with your lawyer, tax professional, and financial planner. Keep in mind that investing in startups can be extremely risky, and there's a potential for loss of your entire investment. Remember to always conduct thorough research and consider your risk tolerance before making any financial decisions. Stay informed, and we look forward to having you join us on our next episode of the Physician Syndicate podcast.